Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's LSE Festival panel discussion entitled Saving the Planet in an Age of Geopolitical Rivalry. My name is Peter Tribowitz. I'm a professor of international relations and the director of the Fallon United States Center here at the school. So tonight's panel grows out of a joint initiative between LSE and Tsinghua University in China, in Beijing, to consider the implications of the resurgence of kind of great power rivalry, economic nationalism, for multilateral cooperation over climate and green energy, trade and growth, public health and well-being. And the U.S. Center and Tsinghua's Institute of International Relations have assembled two teams of scholars, seven on each side, to think through the challenges that geopolitical competition and especially U.S.-China rivalry pose for global sustainability and to explore possible strategies that leaders might adopt to sustain international cooperation in an age of fracture. So we're at the beginning of our two-year journey on this collaborative effort. We've just held our own kind of small working conference, but we wanted to use this occasion. We knew we were going to be here. It was going to overlap with the festival. We wanted to use this occasion to share some preliminary insights about our deliberations. And with me on the round table tonight are five members of the LSE and Tsinghua teams. To my immediate right is Zhao Kujin, who's a professor of international relations and the deputy director of global development, the Global Development Institute at Tsinghua. Next to him is Catherine Boone, who is the Harold Lasky Professor of Political Science and a professor of international development here at the school. Next to Kathy is Stephanie Rickard, who is a professor of political science in the Department of Government here, also at the school. And next to Stephanie, one down, is Tang Xiaoyang, who is the chair of the Department of International Relations, the professor of international relations, also at Tsinghua University. And last but not least is Robert Faulkner, who is a professor of international relations here at the LSE. Welcome. It's great to have all of you here this evening. I'm looking forward to the conversation where many of us have. How many of you were at the John Kerry event? A number of you. Good. Okay, that's great. So I think there's a lot of energy coming off of that. So I've asked the panelists to offer some preliminary remarks, about 5 minutes each. And then what we'll do is we'll move quickly to opening this up for discussion. And I hope that we actually have a real conversation here as opposed to the other event. And for those of you who, for those of you who are in your room, just raise your hand when we get to that point of the evening, and and an usher will come to you with a mic. For those of you online, just use the Q&A function to put your question in, and just make sure to provide your name and your affiliation, your connection to LSE, if you're an alum. And with that, let me just say one last thing. If you haven't already turned off your mobile, put it to silent, please do that. I say this, they did not say that in the past event and they got interrupted by it. So, okay, enough of that. We're done with all the housekeeping. Let's start. So, Eugene.
Hi.
Hi. We have known each other for a very long
time. I'm your followers.
And you have written really a lot, extensively, about Chinese foreign policy. From the Chinese perspective, what is going on geopolitically? What does the geopolitical landscape look like? You know, a view that is very popular in the United States, I think beyond the United States, is that the U.S. and China are at loggerheads and we are drifting towards some kind of a Cold War-style bipolar competition. Is that the way it looks in Beijing? And, you know, if so, what does that mean for Chinese strategy? And if not, what does that mean for Chinese strategy? Great to have you here.
Okay, thank you. Hello, everybody. It's my big honor to be invited here. So this may be my fourth time to visit the LSE, and we have a good relation with Peter and Casey. For your question, so, you know, in the eyes of China's leaders, they have a different understanding towards the world, particularly, you know, alike with the United States. So in my view, there are at least three guidelines for China to explain and understand the current world. So I take some notes and I try to express the idea based on an observation towards China's leaders. The first topic, the first perspective of China leaders is focus on national security, and I call it traditional geopolitics. So that means, you know, take the strategic competition between China and the U.S. as the underlying logic to understand the current world. In the eyes of leaders, they believe the decline of U.S. hegemony and the chaos of international ideology have further intensified the disorder and the fragmentation of geopolitical order. In the past 5 years, as a milestone, the top leaders of China pay more attention to Global South. They believe the Global South is growing rapidly. The reason is, you know, it takes more than 40% of global GDP. That's, you know, promote the multipolarity of the world. And meanwhile, they believe the relative decline of U.S. as a global leadership makes it difficult to sustain unipolar system. And with the deepening of multipolarity in the world, the power structure is becoming more diverse. You know, the strategic autonomy of EU and Japan's strategic dependence on U.S. is still there. So this is, you know, the first fault line for China to understand the world. The second is the non-traditional politics. I call it a new geopolitics, which focus on human security. So with the rapid development of emerging technology like AI and gene editing, and the change in the global interdependence, the global supply chain, the key channels, and the critical miners all have become international game hotspots. There are lots of new geopolitical issues to trouble the world, such as the global food and energy security, information security, critical miners, such like cobalt, nickel, rare earths, are the driving force behind the emerging industry. And the important geographical points and hubs have always been the paramount importance in global geopolitics. That's why in Poussin's summit, China launched rounds of competition over the rare earth rare earths and to, you know, exert strong pressure on U.S. So that's the general judgment by the China's leaders. Besides this, climate change and public health and the transnational crime, all, you know, be regarded as the big challenges for our world. The third fault line is beyond the traditional and the non-traditional geopolitics, which focus on eco-security. So such as the deep sea, polar regions, outer space, cyberspace, and AI are all related to the geopolitics, which affecting China's imagination of the global order and becoming a new frontiers in international geopolitical games. Most substantially, the gap between people and the AI or machine will be the new geopolitical frontiers in the coming decades. So to sum up, in my observation, all three default lines drive China to build a global community rather than control spheres of influence like during the Cold War. So maybe ties out. I stop here. Thank you.
That's great. Okay. Well, thank you. That's a pretty clear view of outline of the Chinese perspective. I want to circle back. I hope other people do as well in the questions about AI and the way that AI might shape that relationship and the relationship with the EU and other parts of the world. But I want to pick up on the reference that you made to critical minerals and to the global south and turn to Kathy. You are a leading scholar, international scholar on Africa. And one of the things that we're talking about in our working group is the scramble for critical minerals that is taking place in Africa and other parts of the global south. And I think the question here for you that is kind of, in a sense, front and center for the group in this issue area is whether or not that scramble is going to put, in a sense, you know, is it a put the countries of Africa in a better position where they're able to leverage it for economic development? And then the sense, is it a blessing? Or alternatively, is somehow that scramble and the preoccupation with developing and tapping and developing those critical minerals can become a curse?
Yes, well, I want to thank the organizers of this panel very much for inviting me to speak, and Professor Zhao for setting up this topic of critical minerals in the green transition. And indeed, talking about the implications of this for African countries as a way of talking about the implications of critical minerals and the green transition and mounting geopolitical rivalry for countries in other parts of the world that are really at the, let's say, on the margins or the periphery of the great power competition. So the increase of demand for critical minerals that has focused so much attention on the African continent in the last decade or so seemed like something that would be a great opportunity for Africa, sort of an opportunity to leverage the global interest in Africa's materials for things that the African countries want, especially to fuel economic development, but particularly industrial policy within African countries. And there was great hope, I would say, maybe 10 years ago or even 5 years ago, that the African countries would be able to leverage the increased interest and increased demand to get better deals around extractive industries from the global investors than they had in the past, so that Africa might finally be able to leverage extractives in a way that promoted economic development, but also it could perhaps help build in guarantees and protections in ways that would protect countries from the the worst aspects of the resource curse. So the environmental degradation, or the pollution, the ripoffs, the non-transparency, the sort of all the bad politics fueled by the resource curse of fueling corruption and authoritarianism, et cetera. It's a very serious challenge for the African countries and one that becomes more serious by the minute. And, you know, I was very struck by what Mark Carvey said at Davos in February, you know, when he talked about an age of heightened geopolitical rivalry. And he said, if you're not at the table in this world, you're going to be on the menu. And I think the fear for the African countries and the other countries with great reserves of especially critical minerals, but not much political power going into it, that these countries will be really on the menu. And so the question, what challenges in particular do the African countries face in this area? I think one of the points that came up earlier in our meetings in our conference was that around maybe 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, there was great hope that the Western countries of the Europe and the United States in a coordinated way would come making interesting offers around investment in critical minerals to African countries as a way for the Western countries to sort of get back into the critical minerals game in Africa. So a game that had been dominated by Chinese investors in the first part of the 20th century. And so there was a kind of promise that the Western investors are coordinated in this way would be able to be more accommodating of the African countries' aspirations for transparency and support for industrial policy, et cetera. The problem of mounting tensions in geopolitical competition is that it seems in many ways to have kind of shifted the interests of these countries that became interested in coming back into the critical minerals sector in Africa in the 2020s. So for the European countries, there's been a shift in priorities. They are more stressed on the security front. They're more constrained on the economic front and, you know, probably less room in their seek to shore up their own economic base and their supply chains, less interest in waiting patiently and building accommodations around African countries' industrial policy. So this falls away as a priority for these actors. And of course, we've seen the Americans are just completely junk the idea of, you know, more accommodative industrial policy with the Trump administration, Trump II administration, leaning very hard into this sort of baldly coercive kind of transactionalism that, you know, offers, you know, sort of threatens African countries as much as it offers them anything positive in return. So we're left with these voluntary agreements, largely private sector governed around corporate social responsibility and environmental, social and governance provisions that are very hard to enforce and with little support in the ecosystem for upholding these kinds of standards when the sort of leading governments behind these companies are pressing them to follow other sorts of priorities, the cost priorities, the rapidity of investment priorities, the shoring up of supply chain priorities. And in many cases, this will mean investing even other parts of the world outside of Africa. So I think, you know, all observers agree that what this means for African countries is that the onus is really on them to make the best of this interest in their critical minerals in a way that really is not, really cannot count on a very supportive international ecosystem in this age of geopolitical rivalry and fracture. So African governments, many have tried to invest and lean into their industrial policy objectives. But I think one thing that has been observed over the course of the last few years is that they have a very hard time realizing their ambitions in this domain. So one hope for realizing these ambitions is more collective action on the part of African countries amongst themselves. So African countries bargaining together either through the African Union or in the regional groupings to try to come together and maybe build larger coordinated markets within subregions of the continent that will sort of give them more leverage in negotiating with outside players, but also maybe allow them to build more integrated supply chains within their regions. But again, this collective action amongst African countries has proved very, very demanding, partially because the institutional infrastructure for this is not very solid, and partially because in the short term, the African countries become competitors within their region. So in the region of Southern Africa, for example, around copper and cobalt, especially, they're competitors with each other, which constrains their capacity to bargain together to get a good deals around critical minerals. So I would say, you know, in sum, that the heating up of geopolitical rivalry and competition, in some ways, although, you know, on the face of it, more demand for what the African countries want to sell, but sort of shifts the balance in ways that apparently makes it harder for them to bargain for the best solutions for themselves. So it's kind of on African governments and on the sub-regional groupings, probably the most capable of those will be able to effectively leverage global demand. But overall, in the absence of some renewed effort on the part of all the international players to support a good governance in critical minerals in African extractives, there's much to worry about on that domain in terms of intensified exploitation of the countries of the African continent around extractives.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Great. Yeah. Maybe picking up a little bit on that, the collective action problem. Stephanie, I mean, we haven't talked about trade. This is probably one area, maybe the area that's been hit perhaps the hardest by geopolitics. I mean, you know, after a couple of decades of kind of stunning growth, trade liberalization, expansion, you know, what we've seen is first a flattening of the curve. Maybe it hasn't exactly come down, but you don't see the same kind of expansion. Is, you know, and it's not only due to geopolitics, but certainly that's in the mix. And I suppose the question for you is that just the direction we're headed, or is there some way of kind of reversing it?
Thanks, Peter. I hate to say it, but that's the direction of travel, right? We see trade increasingly fractionalized, and we see that in multiple ways. The multilateral rules that have for decades kept trade flowing, reduced the cost of doing trade, increased the certainty of doing trade and business across national borders, that consensus is breaking down. And we see that not only in countries being increasingly willing to violate the international rules regulating trade, but also in the increased difficulty in achieving new multilateral agreements. So we increasingly see, for example, countries trying to focus on regional trade agreements, plurilateral agreements, or even bilateral agreements. So think of the United States here, where they're trying to cut deals with all of their trading partners. So the fractionalization is real, it's happening in the trade realm, and it will continue. It's deeply political. Part of the reason we've gotten here is because of geopolitics, but part of the reason is domestic politics. Trade has distributive consequences. It creates winners and losers within every country. And those losers, particularly in some of the countries like the United States, the United Kingdom, Europe, they are politicizing trade. And it's just become a political hot potato. So it's deeply political, but it's not partisan. Don't think that when Trump leaves office, we'll snap back to a happy multilateral world. Unfortunately, we won't. This is the direction of travel. It's bad news for trade. It raises the costs of doing trade. It raises the uncertainty of doing trade. But it's also bad for the environment. Let me give you two examples. First, it's bad for trust. The erosion of the multilateral rules in trade have put us in a low trust environment. And as a result, that really undermines not only existing international environmental agreements, but the opportunity and the ability to achieve future international environmental agreements. So most international environmental agreements are voluntary. You sign up, you police yourself, You say, I'm going to try to hit these targets. But it's much less likely that you'll do that, that you'll put the political will and energy into doing that if you worry that your neighbor's not going to do it, if you don't trust your trading partners. And so this lack of trust and the fact that we're in a low trust environment now makes the enforcement and compliance with current international environmental agreements difficult, but it also really challenges the ability to reach new international environmental agreements precisely when we need them most. So trust is a real problem. The second problem that's a result of this growing fractionalization is in tech. We see, for example, countries have competing policies about how to design EVs, design batteries. Where are you going to source the materials to create these EVs and these batteries? And so as a result, we see fractionalization in all of these rules. And so we potentially are in a situation where the fractionalization in trade, the low trust environment, impacts on green energy tech, the diffusion of green energy tech, and potentially retards the transition to a green economy and a green energy economy. So fractionalization is here. It's the direction of travel. It's bad for trade and the environment.
Well, Stephanie, you just set Xiaoyuang up perfectly because Xiaoyuang is running a large project at Tsinghua on the green energy transition, I think, focused principally on Southeast Asia and maybe Central.
The Global South. Global
I mean, South. What's your kind of view of, let's say, the state of multilateralism and the kind of green energy sector and maybe China's view of the road ahead? Is it as bleak in trade as it is in energy?
Okay, yeah. Actually, China has made significant progress during last 5 or 10 years in green energy transition. So that's exactly amid this geopolitical tension. So that it means declining multilateralism didn't really affect China's green energy transition. That's because for China, the green energy transition, that's not a political discourse, but it's rather a development need. When people are protesting, people are going to COP to advocate the multilateralism for this policy, but they actually neglect that the energy itself, it's actually a development need. You need energy. The reason why you need energy, because that's a part of economic growth, that's a part of industrial development. And for this, then you always need to also work with companies, with industries. So therefore, do not think that you can wait for this all these capitalists and companies to all agree on this beautiful, rosy picture of the world, or going to green automatically. There must be a lot of interests, conflicts, and contradictions. And so when China is doing that, then China, the government and the companies, they actually realize this point. So for them, for a long time, it's not really just about a discourse. Course, but they see actually when China industrializes itself, that means if we follow the older models, then it would be smog, would be unimaginable pollution, and the world may explode. So therefore, for China to continue developing, you must have much better like emission quality and also new energy, new types of energy. So that's why they invest a lot on this renewable energy already 20 years, 30 years ago. And that's not really because of some policy discourse or because of any external pressure, but it's purely because they actually have this long-term vision of development for the world and for itself. So therefore, they are convinced that this direction is inevitable and you must do it earlier and planning it. So therefore, yeah, now the last 5-10 years, maybe also partly thanks to Trump and to this Iranian war, then we see this is even progressing much faster. But what actually interesting for me is when I arrive in London and I see interesting phenomenon. We talk a lot about sustainability, but on the street, we see not so many electric cars, right? So that's actually a big interesting contrast because in China, currently among already like more than 50% of the newly made cars, they are EVs. And yeah, but in UK, I ask the people and they say actually due to an infrastructure or due to some traditional industry sector, we do not see much, although we talk every day about sustainability. I think this will show us the difference between the Chinese approach and what the European approach is about. Yeah.
Well, Robert, that's a pretty interesting perspective, and maybe you kind of want to leverage off it. You have written a lot about geopolitics and the environment and things written on the green energy transition in particular. I guess when you look out like 5-10 years, what do you see as the main challenges? I mean, is the main challenge that we talk but don't do?
I think that's a big part of the story. I think looking out 5-10 years is challenging for us, right? We've just had a by-election and we barely know what's going to happen in the next 3 days with the government in this country. But before I answer the question, I just want to make 2 points. In defense of Londoners, we may not all be driving electric vehicles, but people like me, we don't even have a car. Right, there you go. So that's one. So there's always that alternative, which is the much greener alternative if you can get around on public. Right. And the other one, I just want to say thank you to those of you who've been at the Kerry event because that links nicely into this event. Really appreciate you didn't walk away. Also want to say how gratifying it is to have a former U.S. Secretary of State do the warm-up act for this panel.
Yes.
So I think that's an absolute first for me. I do appreciate that. So thanks to the organizers for doing that. Okay, now back to your question. Sorry, Peter. So you've asked me to think about how geopolitics affects the green transition and sustainability governance. There are many ways in which I could talk about that. I could talk about geopolitical conflict and how what it does to multilateralism. Stephanie talked about it in the trade area. Not a good story. I could talk about geopolitics and the growing competition for green technology and for critical resources. What Kathy talked about, I'm going to leave that aside. I'm going to focus on energy. And I just want to pick on energy because I think there we see how the connection between geopolitics and sustainability is actually much more complex than it seems. And I just want to mention 2 recent geopolitical shocks that we've all lived through in the last few years, at least here in Europe, but in many other parts of the world too. 1, 2022, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which caused a massive energy shock in Europe because it showed that Europeans had been strategically foolish to rely so heavily on cheap gas and oil from Russia. And the European Union has now made a serious effort to wean itself off that Russian oil, and that has caused a huge price hike. And the second shock, of course, was, as already mentioned, what happened in the Gulf, the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran, known as Epic Fury, soon to be known as Strategic Blunder. But that's perhaps for the history books to work out, which is the better label. But again, we found an immediate reaction in energy markets with a dramatic rise in energy prices and yet again a desperate scramble in Brussels, in Berlin, in London, and in Paris for a solution to this endless cycle of rising and falling energy prices because we are still hooked on fossil fuels. And so my question is, what's that going to do to the green transition and to global sustainability governance? How's that geopolitical shock going to work out? So one outcome is, of course, and we see this in a number of countries, that those countries that are already less dependent on fossil fuels are paying a lower price for the energy imports that we're now receiving from other parts of the world. So instead of Qatar, it's now the United States that's providing us with more LNG. We're paying dearly for that. So take Spain, for example. Spain has advanced much further down the solar and wind route, mainly solar. It's now paying less of a price premium due to the war in Iran, right? Those are countries that have learned the lesson, that have taken action further. And so that just shows that in many ways, geopolitics via the energy route is reinforcing the decarbonization argument. And it's simple, right? If you want energy security and less reliance on imported fossil fuels, just invest in solar and wind and do it in the way that my Chinese friend and colleague has described it, with a long-term vision rather than the stop and go that we've seen. The problem is that's not the only outcome, because there are a couple of other countries that have also seen less of a price rise from the energy shock. And I include here the United States. The United States is now one of the largest producers of oil and gas. It's one of the largest exporters of oil and gas. And although consumers have seen a price rise at the gas pump, and we will see what that does politically in November, the increase in that price has been less pronounced. So there are plenty of what we now call petrostates that may actually respond to these energy shocks in a way of doubling down on reliance on fossil fuels. And you see this in the United Kingdom now, where certain parts of the political party spectrum are saying, well, prices go up in energy markets. The green transition is costing us a bomb. We need to now drill for more domestic oil to become independent or not. Whether that's ever a realistic vision or not is another question. So actually, paradoxically, when it comes to the geopolitics of sustainability, we find that the effect that these energy shocks have had is not straightforward. There's a bit of a paradox here. And the paradox is that the world seems to be dividing almost, I'm going to make a slightly exaggerated argument here, the world is almost dividing into what is known as petrostates and electrostates. Countries that are doubling down on their abundant reserves of oil, gas, and coal, that even want to turn that into a strategic opportunity. The current American government talks about not energy independence, but about energy dominance. The U.S. would like to use this as a geopolitical tool. They're certainly benefiting from better export opportunities at a relatively high price. American LNG gas is very dear indeed. And then there are states, China sometimes is categorized in that, we may need to discuss that a little bit, that want to go down the route of electrostates. That is to say, rapid electrification of everything that you can electrify, and then massive investment in renewable energy. Because that really does get you off the oil dependency and the gas dependency. Except, and this is where it gets complicated, the picture isn't quite so straightforward. The petrostates are still investing in renewables, right? We've talked about Texas this morning. Texas is, of course, a sunshine state. And why wouldn't you build more solar panel farms when it's so cheap? they are being produced cheaply in China. Thank you very much. And unfortunately, the electrostates are still pretty heavy on fossil fuels. Yes. China is still building coal-fired power plants. It may be the largest investor in renewable energy, but it's still reliant on fossil fuels and doesn't want to come off those very quickly. And so the paradox that I put to you all is geopolitics is getting in the way, but quite how it works out depends very much on the politics on the ground, and we need to get those politics right.
That's great. That's a great place to leave this part of the discussion, and we're going to transition to...
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just keep it close to 15 minutes to work with.
Stephanie, you said that...
I think we're going to run over like
the U.S.-China rivalry was bad for the environment.
Any question?
At Secretary Kerry's meeting,
he
asserted that the greatest progress at these meetings came when China and U.S. stood together. Maybe using your imagination, what is the roadmap to get back to that point where China and the U.S. can stand together. I know that we might be looking at another administration, but what might be the incentives for that to happen?
That's great. Let's hold that question. I'm going to take a few questions, and that question actually could be for anybody on the panel here, including myself. Yeah.
Thank you for giving this opportunity. I'm Ashish from India and a regular visitor to LSE. So my question is, something has been said about the Global South. So I believe India and China are leading the Global South, man. It's a big force. So what I want to understand from the panelist is, are we seeing a multipolar world where one on one end there is a Global South, then there is a US dominance, and even EU is falling apart from the US dominance. So is there like a three kind of a power shift in the world? And if this is not sorted out, how rest of the things, green energy, etc., is going to work? That's my question. Thank you.
That's a great question. You really should be part of our team. We're kind of trying to think through that alternative futures and so forth. We're going to take a question online. I'll come back around. We'll take another pass, but we'll take one from online.
Thank you. And just to say, we have a number of people watching tonight across the online platform from countries like Canada, Mexico, Croatia, Germany, Mauritius, Norway, the US and UK. This question comes from Anthony, who's an LSE external alum, who asks, on the US trade direction of travel, even if after Trump, the US wants to keep their direction, why couldn't other countries just revert back to the WTO, UN rules-based order? Thank you.
Okay. Stephanie, that last question has you, like, you know, that's you, right? So, yeah. And maybe on the U.S.-China question, I don't know who wants to take a bite at that apple. And then also on the question of whether we're in a, you argued that we're in a multipolar world. So maybe you could take first, Virginia, you could take a first stab at.
Okay, I want to have some response to the Global South and to the competition between China and U.S. So geopolitics is not a bad thing. You know, since the 17th or 19th century, there are many rounds of competition among great powers. That's driven the world from the classic time to modernized time and now to globalized. So this is a objective force drive the world into a new era. We should respect and we should make adaptation to the new situation. So take China and U.S. as the new rounds of competition as an example. So Kathy mentioned, you know, this competition and geopolitics give some opportunity to Africa. Some make the critical minerals, as you know, a big resource to play guards, you know, with the great powers. So that is a positive. Okay. So U.S. from particularly Trump is not, a surprise. Trump, you know, is very smart. He knows print lots of dollars. So U.S. should get more materials to balance this currency. So this is the general condition. So that's why he launched a competition with China and Russia and the rest of the world, you know, to defend Americans' interest. That's just like mentioned to follow the Hamilton's approach to industrialization policy. Okay, this is behind this phenomenon is a strategic and a geopolitical concerns, and so that's the Global South play a middle ground of the great powers. And just like, you know, U.S. and the Soviet Union, you know, make India, make Africa countries, to be a middle ground to balance the U.S. and the Soviet Union. So now it's similar stories. U.S. and China, you know, play cards through the rare earth, through the chips, and then give the countries of Southeast Asia, Africa, you know, to have some advantage to play the cards, you know, on the table. But in the past, they are on the menu. So this is the positive effect of the geopolitical competition. So Island makers, Global South is independent players. So we should respect. So, for UK, for European Union and the US, traditionally they believe in the institutionalism, just put institution design as the precondition for development. But now the situation has changed. For the developed countries, the great power also has an industrial policy. That's why Trump does now. So that is the new situation, new reality, particularly with the rise of another round of revolution in high tech. That's my response. Thank you.
Stephanie?
So on the WTO, let me just be clear. The WTO rules are still operating. In fact, 3/4 of world trade is still being conducted under the WTO rules. So I didn't mean to imply that the WTO is dead. It's not. But the challenge is that when we need to get the United States back on board. And that's really important because the WTO rules are now 30 years out of date. So we need to upgrade them. The rules are simply no longer fit for purpose. Things like AI, services, all of these need to be discussed. We need new rules. And to make that happen, the US has to be on board. So that's the real challenge for us. In terms of the US and China, of course, Secretary Kerry is right. When the two largest economies of the world come together to work towards a goal, that's powerful. But administrative change, a change in the administration alone will not be sufficient. It might help, but it won't be sufficient. Why? Because we're in a low trust environment. Once you lose trust, it's very, very hard to build it back. What could we do? Maybe one way forward is to try to increase transparency. Be far more transparent about what are you subsidizing, how, and why. That's a big ask, but that's one way potentially to get the US and China into an era of more trust.
I would think a little differently. First is about the Global South. And I think the Global South is the key to Global South development lies on the Global South countries themselves. Because actually when you look at the general environment, it's the same for every country. But some Global South countries, they develop, some countries, they fail. And this is rather on how every country should manage their own resources. So actually all this renewable energy and critical minerals, they provide a lot of chance. For me, then, the critical mineral itself is not a chance, but actually this competition between the US and China provide a lot of chance for the Global South. But you should manage that well. And it's not only balance, but also then to make this competition as your internal development momentum. And otherwise, then you just wait for the competition. Then when they stop competition, you are still nothing, right? So you actually, it's how to make this chance for the countries to grow. And also the same is for renewable energy. I see actually an important chance is this makes the energy decentralized. Because before then, you always depend on this expensive oil, or you need a lot of investment especially for transmission for the older centralized power production. But now with solar, with wind and renewable energy, another advantage is you can actually decentralize a lot of energy production and distribution. That will be beneficial for some remote areas to get industrialized, to have access to power. But however, coming back, then these countries then not only having access to energy is one thing, but how to really make this energy to contribute to development, that's actually up to every country. And a lot of countries have different performance with the same technology. And when it comes to China and the US collaboration or coordination, I think competition is also
not a totally bad thing. Even with this administration, with Trump, actually, China already learned how to deal with them. We actually see that and the economy is still growing. The green transition is still happening. Then, yeah, it's actually, I think as long as you are doing well, you can deal with other all kinds of conditions. But actually, if your own self, your own economy is not solid enough, robust enough, any conditions will affect your performance. So it's actually still about your self-development.
Maybe just a coda to this point and to the question about U.S.-China relations. I mean, Kathy and I have been traveling, going back and forth to China for 25 years. And I would say, just to pick up the point that Stephanie made, the level of trust is very low between the two sides. And you can feel that there. You can certainly see it in American politics today. To my mind, the concern is not only what's happening economically, what could happen strategically, militarily. And I think that one of the problems right now is there's not sufficient communication. Back when Kerry was referring, the period he was referring to, military leaders on both sides met on a fairly regular basis. And there was concerns about rules of the road, whether it was in the South China Seas or somewhere else. You know, my fear is that it will take something like the Cuban Missile Crisis to bring everybody to their senses. And I think we want to try to avoid that and think of that, think about how to deal with that up front and in advance so that we, it's possible that that's the smelling salt ultimately. And maybe it's something in the climate space that brings the two countries to that point. But I think just kind of, I think that probably the most important thing is just to have regular contact and think incrementally and try to move, just change the nature of the relationship slowly. So I actually just ended on that note because we have just hit 8 o'clock. I don't know, do we have time to go for another round or a question or two?
Perhaps a quick one.
A quick one. We'll take that question right there and the question right here. Go ahead. And then it'll be a lightning round.
My question is regarding multilateralism and
holding closer.
Please manage.
Okay.
Regionalism. So
multilateralism, that's we tried for 20 or 30 years. It hasn't worked. Why not we focus on either, of course, the developed countries like mentioned, USA, China. They are not interested in regionalism. Why not the regional country like South Asia, ASEAN? Similarly, we have regions in Africa. Why not focus on them? We empower them. Maybe they would be able to solve the common problem we are facing, like ecological crisis. We are facing cybersecurity. And we are, then it's coming now, artificial intelligence. And in the, change is going to happen. In any case,
I think they got the point.
Change is going to happen. Thank you.
Right. And let's just take this last question right up here. Okay.
Hi, thank you. My name is Alejandra. I'm from WSB. So we have talked about a lot of challenges around the geopolitical rivalry between different, well, U.S. and China. And I think I want to go to the basics and ask, what will it take to accelerate into a transition of a green economy? And even though we have these challenges of lack of trust, the paradox with clearly the market, it's not going to change. So we have seen that. So what it will take then to work together as different countries within one aim, which is this transition? Thank you.
Okay. So, Robert, you want to maybe take on that last question? And Shanin, you want to take on the regionalism?
Okay, yeah.
Maybe
should I start? Yeah. Okay, so when coming to regionalism, first, I don't think multilateralism is a way. it's actually just a different levels. Actually, multilateralism still needed. And no matter in international finance and also world trade organization, they are still trying to play a role, right? And so actually globalization, to some extent, they are still going on. Like the AI, we are using more and more the same model. And regionalism, regional value chain, that's what we also discussed in today's conference. That's also happening. So for a lot of small and medium-sized countries, they actually increase this regional cooperation to enhance the something like a multi... Yeah, so the level of cross-country collaboration is just like multi-level. It's not only at one level multilateralism, but there were regional and then also global. But coming to regionalism, then actually it doesn't depend on some like external empowering. I think the most biggest challenge for regionalism is these countries within the region themselves. Look at the example you give. South Asia, Southeast Asia, Africa, do they really want to become a harmonious region? Actually, we see conflicts in every region you are talking about. So that's the biggest challenge.
Robert?
All right. Well, we should ask them if they want to. The one footnote I'd have to your point about do the great powers, the superpowers, care about regionalism? They do. They just call it something different. They call it spheres of influence, right? And that's probably not what you have in mind. So we've got to be careful there. There's a strong view in North America at the moment, in the United States, that the Western Hemisphere should be theirs and theirs only. So I'm sure there are Chinese equivalent views of how the regional order should be ordered. So I think a lot of Global South players will want to be careful about the overall structure that exists in that space. But to the question of how we accelerate the green transition amidst geopolitical rifts, I think that's the critical question to ask. We know why it's going to be more difficult, because with lack of trust and geopolitical conflict, getting agreement on targets will be more difficult. China and the US don't trust each other, so the ambition will go down. The flow of green technology will be slowed down because of the breakdown of trade relations, because of, again, competition over green technology. So those are the critical points we need to work on. So we need to make sure the multilateral framework stays alive, to keep it alive until there's a change of heart, at least in the US. And we need to be sure that green technology does not fall under the bus, under the geopolitical bus that makes it impossible to attract those. It's interesting to note, in uncontroversial areas like solar energy, there's actually very little damage that's been done by US-China kind of rifts, because Chinese solar panels are now so cheap that virtually all countries rely on them. If you look at Pakistan, they've increased their installations of solar energy by a massive amount. A country like Kenya is 90% fossil fuel free in its electricity generation. They're just buying Chinese solar panels without concern for how that plays out geopolitically. So there are some areas where we can just make good progress without worrying about it. But we need to retain the political frameworks to avoid a kind of a breakdown of the political relations that we need to prosper in that space.
Kajin, you want to just say one thing?
So for multilateralism and regionalism, so I believe we need a multilateral track rather than multilateralism. We need regionalization rather than regionalism. So that's why, you know, there are differences between Europe and Asia. In Asia, China, Japan, Korea has a high level of regionalization, but with a low regionalism, that's okay. So now with the rise of, you know, fragmentation all over the world, we consistent temptation to put forward the regionalism and multilateralism. Then you move the focus to the multi-stakeholder model, you know, to organize the process of the dialogue and the cooperation. That's the answer of our current time. And even for U.S. and China competition, they're also a multilateral track. You know, the third party is a very, very important player, you know, in the competition between China and U.S. For example, you know, China work with the U.S. over new technology and a green transition in Middle East. You know, there's computing power from U.S. and, you know, electricity from China. So there is a community of computing power plus electricity. This looks like the, you know, Europeans' experience on the community of coal and steel, you know, cooperation in 1950s. So we can put forward this model of multi-stakeholders model collaboration rather than to take a realism or take the ideal type or institutionalism as a precondition to move forward the collaboration. That's my answer. Thank you.
Folks, there's hope. We are in overtime here. I know that. Please join me in thanking the panelists for a great discussion.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.